Support for WGTD and the Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management and health information management technology. Online degrees for emerging careers from the University of Wisconsin Parkside in partnership with UW Extension. To learn more, visit uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A little later in the hour, we're going to be talking with the co-authors of an interesting book about how to have a healthy and sustainable marriage. But in part one, we're going to be turning our attention to something called PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. This is something that we hear a lot about, although we tend to think of it in the context of people serving in the military who experience trauma and then live with sort of the after effects of it, maybe for the rest of their lives. But PTSD is certainly not limited to people who have been in the military. People can experience trauma in all kinds of different ways, and the ramifications can indeed be very, very serious, very, very life-altering. We're going to be speaking in the first few minutes of today's program with Laura Cox, who is the primary organizer of the second annual event called PTSD Healing Connections, which draws together all kinds of businesses and organizations from the community who have various things to offer to people contending with PTSD. And the second annual event is going to be occurring this Saturday, the 17th of February, at Kenosha American Legion Post 21 at 504 58th Street. And Laura Cox has organized this event in partnership with the Kenosha chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Illness. Laura Cox is the owner of Acupuncture and Wellness of Wisconsin, and she works with a number of people dealing with PTSD, and indeed PTSD is also part of her own life's experience, and we'll talk about that as well. Laura Cox, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So before we went on the air, I asked you if you had some sort of personal reason for wanting to put an event together like this, and you said indeed you did. We'll talk about that in just a moment. First, say a quick word about how you got into the realm of acupuncture, and maybe part of that story maybe has something to do with that other question about PTSD.
Yeah, absolutely. So I started my professional career as a therapeutic massage practitioner. And when I was in school for massage therapy, I took a half-hour class where they talked about acupuncture for just a few minutes. And I knew that that was next. The way that the body works is absolutely fascinating to me. And to think about these ancient medical practitioners who had to figure out a system to explain what was going on with the body before we had any kind of technology is just a really, really neat thing to look into. And their theories that were developed over the thousands of years ago, you know, are really fascinating. And they tend to mirror a lot of the conventional medical diagnoses that we see today. So it might not be the same kind of verbiage when we're talking about a Chinese medical diagnosis versus a conventional medical diagnosis, but to see how they came up with the way that the body works and the way that dysfunction and disease happens oftentimes goes hand in hand with conventional medicine. Hmm. So it's just fascinating to me.
So it's something you became a part of then. And how long have you actually done acupuncture? How long has that been part of your professional life then?
I've been doing acupuncture as a licensed acupuncturist for about 3 years now. I've opened my business 2 years ago, and I've been studying acupuncture since 2010.
Very good. So on to the other question, which was, you know, is there something in particular that draws you to the issue of PTSD? And it's interesting. I realize when I was sort of formulating that question and posing it to you before we went on the air, I'm already sort of mentally answering the question that there's probably somebody in your life mm-hmm. that has suffered from PTSD, and that's what kind of prompted you. In fact, as you told me, No, that's not the case. It's actually you who have actually dealt with PTSD.
Right.
Tell us more about that.
Well, first, everybody knows someone who's been impacted by trauma. So this is not just me. There are many people in my life who have experienced trauma as well. But I personally have something called complex post-traumatic stress disorder, which means that I've been exposed to multiple types of trauma over the course of my life. And they range from abusive situations to getting mugged in Chicago to witnessing and being involved in motor vehicle accidents and more.
Hmm. So all of those events, in a sense, cumulatively create this, in a sense, complex form of PTSD.
Right.
At some point, did you receive sort of an official diagnosis?
Yes, I did seek out conventional treatment, which is basically the form of talk therapy. I saw a few different therapists for about 10 years, and it was immensely helpful. And I should say that PTSD is a serious medical condition, and it's important to make sure that you are getting the right treatment for that. But I found that supportive therapies really made a big difference for me, like getting the acupuncture, regular massage therapy, journaling and meditation were really powerful tools for me. And then I also took some classes through a company called Landmark that helps you kind of take your past and put it back in your past so that you're not living in that past-based conversation day to day. So all of those things combined have really made a huge difference for me. And so I take that kind of approach with my patients where they're getting the medical care that they need from a psychologist or a psychiatrist. And then we're managing some of the other aspects of the way that PTSD manifests through diet, nutrition, lifestyle, and then the acupuncture and massage as well.
Right. So for somebody who is living with PTSD, and again, I think it's so good that we're able to talk to you, because I think most of us, the little that we know about PTSD, it tends to be described through the lens of those who have served in the military.
Sure.
And then they get back home, and then the backfiring of a car or whatever will suddenly spark these terrible memories of something that they've experienced on the battlefield. And while that is, of course, incredibly significant, that is just a small part of sort of the universe of PTSD and a small segment of the population that is so affected. So for someone like you, what is PTSD like? What are the kinds of things that tend to trigger it, or what are sorts of the typical ways in which it, at least in the past, has manifested itself in your life?
Sure. So for me, some of my triggers are witnessing violence. If I see a violent interaction or something that looks like it could escalate into violence, then that puts me immediately on guard. Also, car accidents. I've been in a couple car accidents, and when my car fishtails on the road, that always makes my heart kind of start to race. Some of the symptoms that I personally experience, and really I've gotten very good control over it, so it's not something that happens on a regular basis, but PTSD also never goes away. The hypervigilance is a big one for me. So if I'm walking to my car at night, I have a higher level of elevated awareness of my surroundings than your average person would. And not so much anymore, but nightmares are a really big part of people who are recovering from PTSD. And then the either sleeping too much or not sleeping enough. And for me, after I was mugged in Chicago a few years ago, and I slept with the lights on for about a month and a half. I'm really grateful that it happened in Chicago and not at home here in Kenosha, because that helped me have some distance between that. But flashbacks are something that's like a reoccurring thought or an emotion that doesn't seem to fit into the situation. So I've gotten really good at practicing checking in with, does this emotion match the scenario that I'm in? And if I can say, no, it doesn't match, then I'm able to start looking through, well, what's the root cause of this? Our brains are really fascinating things, and the way that we process trauma is not necessarily a straight line or a cookie cutter approach. And so you might have these like feelings of agitation or aggravation, and you have no idea what's triggering it, when really it's an underlying unprocessed emotion that's trying to manifest itself.
Through the course of your life, particularly from the point that your PTSD was diagnosed, how open have you been able to be about having PTSD? Because sometimes what we hear is people, in a sense, are suffering in silence and
Absolutely.
Isolation, fearful that nobody in their life, nobody they're close to, family or friends, is going to understand or appreciate just how real this is and mm-hmm. just how difficult this is. What has that been for you?
It's taken practice sharing about it. I did publish a collection of poems probably like five or six years ago, and that helped a lot. And the poems that I published were all written during several different abusive relationships that I was in. So it was a processing of the experience of being in an abusive relationship. And once I published that, then people started coming out of the woodworks wanting to talk about it. Mm. And I didn't feel like it was right for me to withhold my experiences from someone who is suffering so much in their experiences. Also, while I was in grad school, I took care of my very dear friend Marcia, who had cancer, and she lived for a year after she was diagnosed with cancer. And once she passed away, I can't tell you how many people who lived through caring for a loved one just started coming out of the woodworks and saying, you know, I took care of my dad who had cancer, or my grandma had dementia, and we took care of her for years. And people don't realize that being a caregiver in that kind of situation can cause some post-traumatic stress as well, from the chronic, repeated exposure to, is this person going to die on me, kind of a feeling. So the more people reached out to me, the more I realized that the silence is deafening. You know, we hear about the silence around domestic abuse or about childhood abuse or all of these other situations, but it tends to be like isolated pockets instead of really addressing, like, there's just this overwhelming silence in our society where we don't like to share the vulnerabilities in our lives. And trauma is a very vulnerable experience. You know, I mean, you're literally being traumatized and you're in a very vulnerable position. And that's the last thing that we as a society want to open up about. But when we keep silent about such an important topic, then people think that they're suffering alone and they don't realize that they're surrounded by people who are also suffering.
Mm. We're speaking with Laura Cox. She is the primary organizer in partnership with NAMI Kenosha of an event that's going to be coming up this Saturday, 1 to 4 in the afternoon, called PTSD Healing Connections at the Kenosha American Legion Post on 58th Street. Laura Cox herself has been dealing with PTSD for a number of years, and that is part of what motivates her to help put this event together, in which a number of different organizations and businesses come together to share what they have to offer to people who are contending with PTSD. So I guess one of the things that's interesting about this event is that there is this plethora of contributors and mm-hmm. presenters, and it sort of speaks to the reality that there are a lot of different ways to deal with PTSD, that it's and it's probably not a one size fits all, and that
Correct.
Certain sorts of interventions and treatments are going to be much more effective for person A versus person B. And so it sounds like you are trying to be open to all of the possibilities and options that can make a difference for people.
Absolutely. And this event is not exclusive to people who have PTSD. As I mentioned before, we all know someone who's been impacted by trauma, and you might not know how to support your brother or your sister or your neighbor or your coworker who's experiencing symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. So this event is also designed to create opportunities for the community to come together and learn about PTSD and learn how to support your loved ones and your friends and your family through their diagnosis of PTSD.
Hmm. I know you have two very special guests that you are especially excited about, and they're going to be giving presentations on Saturday.
Yes.
So tell us, first of all, about Eileen Abrams from Milwaukee.
Eileen Abrams is a psychologist who works for the Milwaukee Department of Corrections, and she has done specific presentations on the adverse effects of childhood trauma. And then she also looks at how trauma impacts our community as a whole. I'm really excited to have her coming in because she's done a lot of work with the NAMI branch in Milwaukee, and she's done a lot of work for her community. So having her come to speak is going to really be a phenomenal experience, and we're really fortunate to have her joining us.
Very good. And then you have someone by the name of Don Medlach, who it sounds like is undertaking a very interesting project on PTSD that one hopes will really make a difference. What is he doing?
Dan is a nurse, a psychological nurse in Milwaukee as well, and he's currently going through his doctorate program. And for his PhD project, he's working with first responders and firefighters and EMTs and police officers out in the county in correlation with an organization called Dry Hooch, and just really looking to see how PTSD is impacting that population specifically and bringing them support, because specifically with the firefighters and the police officers, there's a culture of kind of man up about it, you know, and men are impacted by trauma just as much as women are, and they have the unfortunate impact of our society expecting men to not demonstrate emotions. So I'm really excited to hear about his project and how he's working with people right here in Kenosha County and making a difference in our community.
Hmm. Well, and I think you're pointing to something that also, even beyond the matter of many men have trouble, in a sense, owning their own vulnerabilities, whatever they may be. But I think also when you're talking about, for instance, anybody who is a first responder.
Yes.
Or anybody who is in the military. And there are certain other professions, too, where I think that's where probably what brought them, what drew them to doing that, to devoting their lives to that, is this sense of being of service, mm-hmm. being a figure of strength and courage and so on. And to have those people themselves suddenly experiencing terrible senses of vulnerability and weakness and so on,
yeah.
It just runs counter probably to, in many ways, what they envision themselves being, and makes it all the more difficult, I should think, for them to face up to this unfortunate reality.
Absolutely. Now, with the military, fortunately, they're starting to recognize the impacts of trauma. And over the years, the military has done quite a lot to offset some of the impact for those combat veterans specifically. But you don't have to be a combat veteran in the military to have PTSD either.
Right.
So that's why we think military when we think PTSD, because the military has done such a great job of bringing that to our awareness.
So give us a sense of some of the other participants who are going to be part of the event on Saturday.
Okay. Well, my business will be there, Acupuncture and Wellness of Wisconsin. I'm really excited to have Just Live come. And they're an organization that was founded after Jamie Wilson committed suicide, and she inspired her family to create this organization to raise awareness of suicide and offer education and prevention. They have an amazing music festival every Labor Day weekend to raise funds, and they've raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for suicide prevention and education. We have an acupuncturist from Milwaukee who teaches meditation classes, Paul Schinkel. We have Ann Robbins, who's the comfort coach. She offers a service called Traeger, which is a really soothing rocking technique. We have a massage therapist who's going to be doing hands-on table massages at the event as well. Bridges is going to have some information, and NAMI, of course, will have some information as well. We have Ollie Nelson from the Department of Veterans Services here in Kenosha setting up some info about veterans services as well.
Wow. So quite an array. Real quick, what is it that acupuncture can offer to someone with PTSD?
Acupuncture is a really, like, broad treatment, but specifically there's a protocol that puts different points in the ear, and it really helps to trigger that calm state. So we have the fight or flight state, and then we have the rest and digest. So it really triggers that rest and digest state of your nervous system, and it allows your central nervous system to just start calming down. And oftentimes, as soon as that first little tiny needle gets put into the ear, people will take a big sigh, and just you instantly see them starting to relax on the table.
Interesting. And I'm sure for somebody contending with PTSD, that should be, I should think, an immense relief.
Absolutely.
But again, this event on Saturday features a number of different organizations and businesses and a wide array of possibilities in terms of help and treatment for people contending with PTSD. So is this an event for which people have to register or pay an admission? I mean, how does this work? Who is welcome to come to this?
Everyone is welcome. It may not be appropriate for children. We're not going to have anything like directly that's going to be negative for children, but it's a very serious subject, and you may want to talk to your kids about it if you decide to bring them. It's not designed for children, but everyone is welcome. It's free. It's open to everyone that wants to come in. We're going to have food offered by Waterfront Warehouse, and we have some students from the high school that are going to be playing music. Some orchestra students will be setting a really soothing tone in between the presenters. And
are you suggesting that people come for this entire event? I mean, show up at
Absolutely.
1 and stay till 4?
Absolutely.
So it's more that than a drop in and out kind of thing.
Right. You can drop in and out, but you really don't want to miss out on the presenters. They're going to be giving some really fascinating information.
Very good. So this is, again, at the Kenosha American Legion Post 21, but this isn't particularly limited to people from Kenosha. Anybody listening to this who is interested should feel welcome to come again to the Kenosha American Legion Post 21. That's at 504 58th Street. And the event is titled PTSD Healing Connections. And among the many presenters and also the primary organizer, Laura Cox, owner of Acupuncture and Wellness of Wisconsin. Laura, it's been great to meet you and great to hear a bit of your story. And thank you for your hard work on behalf of this very, very important issue and putting together this important event with NAMI of Kenosha. Best wishes to you.
Thank you very much.
You bet. It's 8:34 and time for part two of today's program here on WGTD. For the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, we are going to talk about how couples can stay together and stay happy together. In fact, that's the title of the book at hand, Happy Together, Using the Science of Positive Psychology to Build Love That Lasts. And the co-authors of this brand new book, our husband and wife, Suzanne Pileggi-Powelski and James Powelski. Suzanne is a freelance writer and well-being consultant and regular contributor to Psychology Today and Live Happy. And it is her 2010 article called The Happy Couple that really served as the the primary catalyst for this book. Her husband, James Powelski, is professor of practice and director of education in the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania. And again, the book they have written together is called Happy Together, Using the Science of Positive Psychology to Build Love That Lasts. We welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having us here today.
It's great to be here with you, Greg.
It so happens that this is the third time within the last year and a half that positive psychology has been mentioned on my program by a guest under one circumstance or another. So I don't think we actually have to maybe belabor that point. But for anybody who didn't hear either of those previous conversations, it probably would be helpful to say a quick word about what distinguishes positive psychology from just standard psychology.
Absolutely, Greg. So standard psychology or mainstream psychology focuses on what's wrong with people and how to correct it, which of course is important. Positive psychology focuses on what's right with people and how to cultivate it, which also is important, and we think it's a lot more fun.
Right, and of course, particularly when it comes to the matter at hand, when it comes to trying to make a romantic relationship or marital relationship a happier one. You say early in the book, actually, that this book is actually applicable in many respects to any kind of relationship. And I would assume even when it comes to nothing but a friendship, not that friendships aren't important, but that this book, at least in large measure, could be very much applied to those sorts of things. But you intended especially to apply to romantic relationships. What kind of is the difference here, or in what way is this steered towards the one particular matter?
That's a great question. And yes, while the book's focused on romantic relationships, the tips and the habits and the research that we have in the book can be applied to any relationship because we interact with people on a daily basis, whether it's our friends, our colleagues at work, family members. But this book is specifically for long-term relationships because we tend to be with those people the most, and it's those healthy habits that we build up over a lifetime that show they're beneficial to helping sustain a marital or a long-term romantic relationship.
Mm. And Greg, we use positive psychology throughout the book. We put it within a philosophical framing, though. I'm a philosopher, so we think that framing really helps to make some of the key theoretical points. And maybe by just mentioning briefly what that theoretical framing is, that'll help make the point between friendships or relationships at large and romantic relationships. So one of the things that Aristotle wrote about in the Nicomachean Ethics some 2,500 years ago or so is that human beings love three things. We love what is useful, what is pleasurable, and what is good. And he says we have friendships that correspond to each of these loves. So we have friends that we like to hang out with because it's useful to do so. Think of folks getting together to start a business and be successful. Aristotle says there are people that we like to hang out with because it's pleasurable to do so. Think of people we like to go out on the town with on the weekends. And Aristotle says there's nothing wrong with these kinds of friendships, but there is a third kind of friendship that is likely to be more mature and more stable, and that is friendship based on the good character we see in the other person. And when we see that good character in the other person, it can actually inspire us to want to be better people ourselves. So that perspective applies to all kinds of relationships and friendships. Susie, though, on our honeymoon, took this in an interesting direction.
So as we were sitting on the beach on our honeymoon 8 years ago this week, talking about Aristotle, because isn't that what everyone talks about on their honeymoon?
On the beach.
When you're married to a philosopher, you are. So we're talking about the notion of an Aristotelian friendship, and I said to James, why does this have to just be limited to friendships? What if we took Aristotle's idea and we bumped it up a level and we applied it to our marriage? So instead of just being lovers, we became Aristotelian lovers, focusing on the goodness and the strengths we see in one another and helping to, really nurture those strengths and become better as an individual and better as a couple. And he said, I love that idea.
And that's become the foundation of our marriage, and we think that, and for the book as well, and so we invite others to adopt that perspective on looking at marriage, not for what you can get out of it so much, it's useful or it's pleasurable, although we hope that there's usefulness and pleasurableness in a marriage, but also for what you can put into it and how you can help each other to grow.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with James Pawelski and Suzanne Pileggi Pawelski. They are husband and wife and co-authors of the book Happy Together, Using the Science of Positive Psychology to Build Love That Lasts. I appreciate the fact that your book is not only makes reference to, for instance, Aristotle, but it also makes reference to two very, very popular films from, I forget now if we're talking about 10 or 15 years ago, but one of the films is As Good As It Gets, and the other film is Jerry Maguire. And there are key moments in each of these films and sort of key phrases that, in your mind, represent two different approaches to having a happy romance and a happy marriage, and in some respects they sort of sound a little bit the same, and yet in many respects philosophically they are completely different from one another, or sharply different anyway. Explain what these two films and the important lines from each of them can tell us about how to approach romantic relationships.
Sure. So I think everybody is probably familiar with that popular line in Jerry Maguire when the lead character played by Tom Cruise just suddenly appears to Renee Zellweger's character and says, "You complete me." And the music goes up and she's crying. And I think women and men everywhere thought that, well, that's the ideal romantic notion. And while it may feel good in the moment, we feel a movie that As Good As It Gets has a better line that is more, is a healthier version. And that's the line when Jack Nicholson's character says to Helen Hunt's character, "You make me want to be a better man." If you look at "You Complete Me," it implies that I'm incomplete without you. And research shows that those sort of relationships where you're depending upon somebody else to fill something that you feel that you're lacking, it could be, you know, pretty detrimental to relationships, because you could be waiting around, waiting for that person to complete you. You could have a sense of fate that, well, you know, once I find this person, then I'll do this, that, and the other. And really, it's kind of inaction instead of being proactive and going after what you want and working on yourself. And As Good As It Gets, that more shows a you compliment me, we think, is better than you complete me. So Jack Nicholson's character in the beginning, you know, he has flaws and imperfections like we all do, but seeing the goodness in Helen Hunt's character, he is inspired by her and he wants to be better. And then together, it's more of a, what researchers say, interdependence, where I'm working on myself, you know, my partner's working on himself, and we're coming together stronger as an individual and stronger as a team. So, again, we feel that "You compliment me" rather than "You complete me" is better for healthier relationships over the long term.
Right. And so there's a point in the book in sort of spelling out what this really means to be an Aristotelian lovers together, that there are three things, and one of them is what we've talked quite a lot already about, that partners see the good in each other. They are committed to supporting each other in their own growth. And I was really intrigued by the third, which is a very important factor, of course, and that has to do with each partner themselves and being committed to being the best that they themselves can be. And I suspect that if you left that out of the equation, this wouldn't work nearly as well.
Yeah, that's a really key point that you picked up on, Greg. And if you go back to Jerry Maguire, the reason that relationship, you know, she mentions that she loved Jerry for what he could be. And there's a beauty to that. There's also a huge danger to that, right? If we get into relationships because what the other person could be, the chances are we're going to be focused on helping to make sure they know they're not there yet and that they need to get where we think they ought to be. And, you know, we've all been there, and it's not pretty. Whereas if I'm motivated to move forward in my own self-development within the context of this relationship, then I don't have to rely on Susie to remind me that I'm not where I need to be yet, and if only I did X, Y, Z, and maybe A, B, C, and D as well, I'll get to my full potential. So that internal intrinsic motivation, psychologists call it, is really crucial so that it's not just a matter of extrinsic motivation. Somebody else is telling me how I need to live my life.
And, of course, we should say that your book not only spells all of this out, but also includes fairly tangible exercises that you encourage the reader to do to really help learn how to do this and how to do this better. That reminds me of something early in the book when you say that ideally a couple would sit down together with this book and read it together and work through these exercises together. Although I think you said that at some point that even if someone cannot explore the book that way, if your partner is absent or even if you don't have a partner or your partner is unwilling, there is still something to be gained from exploring this and even doing some of these exercises even on your own. Do I remember that correctly?
Definitely, that's correct. We encourage anyone to work on strengthening his or her strengths and to work to become a better person themselves, not waiting around for their partner. And often what you find is when you're working on your own things that, you know, other people are inspired and then want to do the same.
And, Greg, we wrote this book for anyone who's interested in relationship-building skills. That could be people who are in, you know, healthy relationships and don't want to take them for granted and want to take them to the next level. It could be people who are in romantic relationships that don't feel very romantic anymore and they want to kind of get things back on track. It could be for people who just seem to be star-crossed and whatever relationship they get into, they seem to wind up, those relationships seem to wind up in failure. This isn't just something that we're fated to have to experience. We can develop our relational skills. And so even if we're not in a relationship as well, we can begin to engage in that process so that when we are in a relationship, we'll be more ready. We like to talk about the relationship gym. If you think about our bodies, the physical side of health, it's important for us not to take that for granted, but to go to the gym, to exercise, to put effort into it, and to direct that effort wisely. So in relationships, we think it's important not just to take things for granted, but to work hard on developing the specific skills that can help us to be more successful in relationships, rightly directing that effort. Again, whether we're coupled at the moment or not, we think this can be a very important way to focus our energies to build love that lasts.
One of the exercises in the book that intrigued me very much, and I think this is an exercise that I really see how it could also pay handsome dividends for somebody, even if the matter at hand is not one of a romantic relationship, but maybe some other kind of relationship. It involves imagining oneself as a superhero and either wearing a green cape or a red cape most of the time. Explain to our listeners the distinction that's part of this exercise and why it's helpful for somebody to examine this facet of themselves.
Sure, Greg. So this is a thought experiment that is our favorite way of kind of explaining the position, the perspectives of positive psychology. Imagine that you are at a flea market and you purchase an odd-looking, interesting-looking lamp, and you take it home, and you clean it up, and as you rub it, out pops a genie. And the genie says, Greg, I've been waiting for you. You're an outstanding human being. I'm going to transform you into a superhero. The first decision you have to make as a superhero, though, the genie says, is what color do you want your cape to be? On the one hand, you can choose a red cape. And if you choose the red cape, you will have the power to fight against the things in the world that we don't want: poverty, injustice, hunger, violence, and so forth. On the other hand, if you choose the green cape, you will have the power to fight for the things in the world that we do want: harmony, love, peace, understanding. And the genie wants to know which color you would choose. So I'm curious, Greg, which color would you choose?
I actually, although I think of myself as a very positive person, I actually probably would be very tempted to choose the one cape that sort of attacks problems, because I think I spend so much time thinking about what's wrong with the world, and I think my gut reaction is to go after the problems and rather than pursuing the solutions, if that's one way to think about the distinction.
Absolutely, Greg. Look, I think we're wired that way. As we've developed in evolutionary terms, we've developed to be very sensitive to threats. Problems scream at us. Opportunities whisper. So if you think about being, you know, living our lives, and particularly our relational lives, it certainly is important to be aware of threats. The problem is we can overuse the red cape and underuse the green cape. And, of course, we need both. And so the end of the thought experiment is not that one is right and the other is wrong, but we need a reversible cape. It needs to be red on one side and green on the other side. But, again, we tend to underuse the green side of the cape. So in this book, we're focused on the opportunity side. And you can imagine, again, in relationships, if you're focused on what's wrong with the relationship, what's wrong with your partner, maybe even what's wrong with you, that's not going to be a formula for a very successful relationship. There needs to be balance where you're focused at least as much and probably a lot more on what's right with your relationship, what's right with your partner, what's right with you, and how you can feed and augment that side of the relationship.
We like to use the metaphor of a garden as well, because, of course, you need to pull weeds, but if you don't plant anything, you can't grow beautiful flowers. And like in a relationship, you could be fixing problems, but if you're not building positive emotions and, you know, harmonious passion and the other things we talk about in our book, you know, you might just be sort of, you know, at a even keel, but not, you know, really thriving. The relationship might survive, but just kind of languish. So it's important to grow things as well and nurture what's good in the relationship.
Right, because this is not just about making a relationship survive. If possible, it's about making a relationship thrive and flourish.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And interestingly, I think there's some connection there, right? So if all we're focused on is making the relationship survive by using the red side of the cape or simply by pulling weeds, ironically, we may actually be endangering the survival of the relationship. But if we can focus more on, or in a balanced way, on the green side, on the good side, on growing the relationship, then interestingly, that may also help the relationship not only to grow, but also buffer it against those things that threaten its very survival.
Hmm. I want to make sure that people have a clear understanding of how this book is different from, of course, the hundreds, if not thousands, maybe tens of thousands of books that have already been written in terms of helping people have happier marriages. Early on, as you are introducing the book, you say this book is not titled 13 Steps to a Blissful Marriage. I think it was really important to you to not write a book that is full of what you call easy promises.
That is correct. Our book is the first book on focusing what's going right in relationships instead of wrong, based on the science of positive psychology. So we took the research, fabulous, great research that's just coming out as we speak, and a lot of it's just in academic texts, and it hasn't been widely popularized. You know, lots of times you hear about, you know, the 10 things that destroy a marriage or destroy a relationship, but you don't hear as much on scientific evidence for things that help build a relationship. So that's how our book stands out from the others. And it's also saying, you know, relationships, like anything, isn't easy in life. It takes effort. And we found it really interesting that, as James mentioned, the gym metaphor. But it's true, like with our bodies, you don't just buy a membership and think I'm going to be fit overnight. And it seems like in our culture, there's so much focus on the wedding rather than the marriage, on getting married rather than being married. And once people are married, it's kind of like they just assume, now I'm going to be happily ever after. We don't do that with our, you know, workouts. we work out if we're intended to be fitter, more flexible. You know, it's a lifetime pursuit. And with jobs as well, right? You don't get your first job in radio and think you're going to be an award-winning journalist. You practice over, you know, years. So why is it in a romantic life, you know, we just think often that it's just going to happen, or there's some, you know, magical potion that Mr. and Mrs. Wonderful is going to come into my life and we're going to, you know, coast into the sunset. So our book is set in science. It's the first book focusing what's right. And it's saying it takes effort. It takes work. There is no easy cure.
That's right. Exactly right. And Greg, we wanted to make sure that people didn't, you know, there's so much pressure on this mythology of perfection and so on. And we wanted to make sure that people didn't make the false assumption that Susie and I were writing this book because we have everything figured out. Our relationship is perfect. It's merely one blissful moment after another. And we, too, will share this information with people. And by reading a single book, they, too, will have, you know, marriages that are nothing but bliss. This is real life. And so we don't believe in those kinds of magical promises. We do believe, though, in hard work, well-directed effort. We believe in fun and romance. And we think that by keeping it real, that people will have a better chance to improve their relational lives over the long term.
In a sense, this book is about that third phase of the story that fairy tales tend to ignore. There is the meeting and the falling in love and then the riding off into the sunset. And typically that's all we see is just this lovely couple horseback riding off into the distance. And we have no idea from that point on what they talk about, where they go next, what they do. And in a sense, your book is to help us through that. Here's a last quick question. Early on, again, in the book, in terms of talking about what this book is not and what your approach is not, there is the line, marriages are not meatloafs. So, I mean, I think most of us would agree, but why are you saying marriages are not meatloafs?
Yeah, I mean, meatloafs, with all due respect to those who can make a killer meatloaf, you know, you follow a recipe or you tweak it a little bit, and you can pretty much create a really good meatloaf every time. Whereas with relationships, you know, we're continually becoming somebody we never were before. And so what works yesterday may not work today because, you know, Susie's feeling different, I'm feeling different, we're growing, learning. So relationships, again, are something that we continually need to work at along the way. And so that's one reason, Greg, why we wrote this book, to help couples as couples, but also to help bring together people in community. So we have a website where we invite people to come for more information. There's a lot more there. And also to come together and share stories about what it's like to be Aristotelian lovers along the way. So that website is buildhappytogether.com. And we hope that this will catalyze a kind of shift of perspective away from problem orientation merely, away from an expectation that we'll just kind of magically be able to live happily ever after, and towards a more realistic prospect where we look to what's good in a balanced way, and we have effort, both as individuals and as couples, but then also as a larger community.
And we put the word build in it because we think love is an action verb. You don't just sit back and wait for it to happen, but you have to work at it over a lifetime.
The book, again, is called Happy Together, Using the Science of Positive Psychology to Build Love That Lasts. The book is published by Tarcher Perigee and the authors, Suzanne Pileggi-Powelski and Dr. James Powelski. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your fascinating book. I think it will be a great help to a lot of people, and I enjoyed the opportunity to speak with you about it. Thank you, and best wishes.
Thank you so much, Greg. It was great.
It's been a real pleasure, Greg. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll hear the interview I recorded with Melba Petillo-Beals, one of the so-called Little Rock Nine. The Little Rock Nine were nine young people, all African-Americans, who were used to integrate Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. It was an incredibly dramatic moment in civil rights history. Melba Petillo-Beals has written several books about that experience. Her most recent is a book intended for young readers. On Thursday, we'll be honored to have with us in the studios Corey Mason, the newly elected mayor of Racine, along with Nan Calvert. On Friday, Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli and several members of the Carthage Choir will be talking about their tour to Europe, which took them to Rome, Venice, and Budapest, among other beautiful cities in